Hi, Marco here. January will be here before we know it, and that means time is running short to make your gift before our fundraiser ends on December 31st. A sincere thank you to everyone who has already donated to our nonprofit newsroom this year. It truly means a lot. Your gift helps ensure that we are able to continue this crucial work. And if you haven't donated yet, now is the time. We need you. Your donation goes far beyond dollars and cents. It validates the importance of our work and enables us to tell the stories that matter to listeners like you. You're not only helping our newsroom flourish, you're also paying it forward for your fellow listeners who are not in a position to donate right now. Please make your gift today to sustain our nonprofit newsroom. You can head to theworld.org/give to donate and learn more. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you so much. Israel says it's not just fighting Hamas, it's facing seven fronts, including against Iran, Syria, and Lebanon. Inside Israel, another front is reopening, the battle that started last year between many Israelis and the Netanyahu government.
Yeah. I think that our anger towards the government is not diminished. It's been growing and growing. But finally, someone called the battle cry, okay, we're starting again.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, Vladimir Putin's most vocal critic, Alexei Navalny, has been located.
He addressed his supporters saying, hey, I'm your new Santa from beyond the Arctic Circle.
He has not lost his dark sense of humor, and we take part in an icy holiday tradition in the North Sea.
You've got to go right in and get your head wet.
Head wet?
Yep, that beard's got to go in. Totally immersed.
All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for being with us on this holiday week. We begin this Tuesday with the situation in the Middle East, where Israel's defense minister today says his country is fighting on seven different fronts, hostilities sparked by Israel's war against Hamas after the group's October 7th attack in southern Israel. Yoav Gallant cited Gaza, but also Lebanon, Syria, the West Bank, Iraq, Yemen, and Iran. The U.S. is also beginning to feel the sting of this fight. On Christmas Day, Iraqi militants injured three U.S. service members in an attack on the Erbil Air Base in northern Iraq. The U.S. military responded with airstrikes on three militant facilities. To get a better sense of what's going on, I spoke with Matthew Levitt, a fellow at the Washington Institute on Near East Policy, and began by asking him about the Iranian general who was killed in Syria.
This particular general is believed to have been the head of the Revolutionary Guards Corps in Syria. He's known to U.S. officials already because of his involvement in some of the behind-the-scenes financing for the explosive-form projectiles that were targeting U.S. servicemen and women in Iraq. So this is not an unknown figure. It's a pretty significant hit, and you can see from the response, both from Iran insisting that Israel will pay for this, and from Lebanese Hezbollah much saying the same, that they too believe that he was an important person. I think in part it was a signal from Israel that it's no longer going to do nothing when it's being attacked from other fronts beyond the obvious war front in Gaza, the West Bank, which had already been hot even before October 7th, and the hostilities with Hezbollah across the blue line on its northern border.
I mean, taking the bigger picture into view, that bigger picture and frame being the wider Mideast and reaction to Israel's continuing military campaign in Gaza, how significant is this death of an Iranian general in Syria?
I think it's very significant, not just because he's an Iranian general, but this Iranian general. So Iran's been trying to play its own role in this conflict, and this particular individual leading the IRGC forces in Syria was particularly important. I think it's a signal also for other Iranian proxies, the Houthis in Yemen, for example. And one of the things we're seeing is that this really is no longer just an Israeli struggle in the region. The U.S., Saudi Arabia, even today with a drone that was shot down near an Egyptian resort on the Red Sea, Egypt getting involved in taking on the Houthi effort to shut down international waterways. There's an international naval task force with some 20 countries committed to this. This is becoming something bigger, and the question is, how far does Iran and its proxies, how far do they want to push this?
We know Israel has long worried about keeping its borders secure. I mean, secure borders is kind of the unwritten fundamental deal Israel has with its citizens. If it's willing to widen the conflicts, wouldn't that erode its promises to keep Israelis safe?
I think the current administration in Israel already has a problem with the fact that, you know, Netanyahu ran on a platform of Mr. Security, I can keep you safe. and that failed spectacularly and painfully on October 7th. You now have people not only evacuated from the south in Israel, but from the north because of Hezbollah rockets. Israel is now beginning to signal that it's not willing to do nothing. And I don't think that this is going to be signaling a huge wave of Israeli attacks in the region. But I think this is Israel saying there's a cost to trying to take advantage of the situation in which we find ourselves from Israel's perspective, defending itself against the massacre on October 7th. And this is a very powerful message in that direction.
Matthew, while the body count continues to climb in Gaza, how would you assess the concern in Washington that regionalizing this war could produce some disastrous results, both for Israel and for the U.S., at the very least reputationally?
There's no question the U.S. is very focused on this issue and on trying to message to Iran and its proxies that there are costs to trying to make more instability in the region on the backs of October 7th. And so you're seeing U.S. actions just over the holiday targeting Iranian proxies. You see the United States putting together a coalition of some 20 countries to deal with the maritime threat in the Red Sea. And I see this as something that the United States and Europe, among others, are actively trying to contain.
Bottom line, Matthew, in the coming months, you think Israel's actions will be reactive or proactive?
Well, they're reactive in the sense that they're reacting to October 7th and to a policy we can now say in retrospect that was misplaced, of thinking that they could deter their adversaries, Hamas in the south and Hezbollah in the north. Understanding that that policy of deterrence alone won't work, I think we can expect that there will be over the coming months ongoing efforts to change the nature of the threats that Israel faces. Not all of that will be the intense kind of fighting we've seen so far in Gaza. I expect that to close out within the next few weeks. But over the months that follow, you'll see Israel still trying to change the reality. And in particular, I think, once the fighting in the south has ended, you'll see more attention to the north.
Matthew Levitt is a fellow at the Washington Institute on Near East Policy. He joined us from Washington. Matthew, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's remember that for a year prior to October 7th, Israelis had been protesting against their government, enraged by the judicial reforms proposed by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his government.
He has reached that stage where he simply no longer cares, you know, like the worst dictators. That's where we are, unfortunately.
One Israeli voice there, an example of the anger over Netanyahu. After Hamas's October 7th attacks, the anti-government protests stopped. But as Rebecca Collard reports, Israelis are now back on the streets and say their message is more important than ever.
On Saturday night, Yoav Lorch joined a crowd of Israelis gathering in central Tel Aviv. It was the first time he's been protesting since Hamas's attack on October 7th.
You know, we're used to it in Israel. There's this sentence that when people are shooting, we shut up. So this is natural, Lal, that we kind of, it's in our DNA in a way to accept it.
Since October 7th, Israelis have rallied in support of hostages and their families, but now they are back chanting for the prime minister to resign. Thousands of protesters like Lorch braved the pouring rain in Tel Aviv and other Israeli cities.
I think that our anger towards the government has not diminished.
Yeah.
It's been growing and growing. But finally, someone called the battle cry and said, okay, we're starting again.
Some held Israeli flags, others held photos of Netanyahu with a bloody handprint on his face. The poster that symbolizes what many in the crowd say. They hold their prime minister responsible for Hamas's attack.
He's in charge, you have to take responsibility because it's in his shift.
Kati Bar is a member of Mothers Against Violence. She says it was Netanyahu's mismanagement of the country that allowed militants to carry out their attack. A poll last month predicted that if new elections were held here, Netanyahu's Likud party would lose almost half their seats in Israel's Knesset. Barr accuses the prime minister of using the war to stay in power.
And I think this war works for Bibi to keep his control and the government.
Yeah.
This is what we're thinking of.
Yeah.
We are in a very, very difficult situation here.
The anti-government protests first popped up again last week. Among the speakers there was Iran Etzion, a former deputy head of Israel's National Security Council. He had a message for Netanyahu.
You've done all the damage that you could, and now there is, you know, you must go because you need to pay the price for your responsibility for October 7th. He has reached that stage where he simply no longer cares, you know, like the worst dictators. That's where we are, unfortunately.
And he says behind that dictator is an increasingly right-wing ultra-nationalist movement in the Israeli government. That's what people were protesting before October 7th, and that's why they're back.
One of the things that they're doing is that they're calling for indiscriminate use of force, both in the West Bank against Palestinians, and we're seeing, you know, the evidence of that, and also in Gaza for IDF soldiers under the slogan of, you know, there are no innocents in Gaza, as horrible as it sounds. Now, obviously, people here do not share that view.
Kati Barr, with Mothers Against Violence, says Israelis aren't getting a true picture of what's happening in Gaza in their media. And she says the events of October 7th pushed some in her movement out of the peace camp.
It was so traumatic for us. And a lot of women in Israel, that was very big groups in the left side, in the left, and for peace, women for peace, became right side.
And did it change anything for you, the 7th of October, like the way that you feel or your hopes?
More strong to find the humanity in me, because this is the only way we can survive this time. And at the same time, I can look at Gaza, what's happening there. I understand it's a war, but I do not accept all the things that Israel doing there for children.
Barr knows she's in a minority here. In a poll last month, more than half of Israelis said they believed their army was using too little force in Gaza. Israel's President Isaac Herzog has warned that internal divisions in his country could hurt Israel's war effort and security. But the protesters say what's hurting the country now is Netanyahu's leadership. For The World, I'm Rebecca Collard, Tel Aviv.
When Danish architect Jørn Utzon designed the famous opera house in Sydney, Australia, he imagined its roof as an array of white sails. For years, that iconic roof has been used as a blank canvas, lit up with animation and artwork, for example. Tourists from all over the world visit every day, taking photos of the roof, those gleaming white sails soaring into the sky. Over the years, those sails have been emblazoned with the Olympic colors. They've been bathed in blue and yellow in solidarity with Ukraine. Just after the Hamas terror attacks, the sails were lit up in white and blue, the colors of Israel. That decision was announced by New South Wales Deputy Premier Prue Carr.
The Premier has decided to light the sails of the Opera House to stand with members of the Australian community who are affected by what has happened.
That night, hundreds of pro-Palestinian protesters rallied at the Opera House, angry at the decision. Some threw flares onto the steps of the building. Later, the New South Wales government was criticized for dragging the Opera House, a UNESCO World Heritage Site, into an international conflict and splintering public opinion in Australia to boot. Now the Premier is backing a draft proposal that would cap how often the Opera House sails can be lit up and for what reasons. The new rules would take it down to just 44 nights of the year. Last year, the sails were lit up one in every 5 nights, including for St. Patrick's Day, Chinese New Year, Diabetes Awareness Day, and to mark the death of Olivia Newton-John. Supporters of the Cleanse the Sails campaign say using them for so many reasons had kind of gotten out of hand. Richard Evans was the head of the Opera House from 2008 to 2012.
The issue with lighting a building of the iconic status of the Opera House, and, you know, it's one of the greatest buildings of the 20th century, is that the more you do it, the less impact it has.
Under the revised policy, the roof of the Opera House would only be lit up for, quote, exceptional non-commercial occasions. That non-commercial part is important. In 2018, there was a huge public backlash when the sails were used to advertise a horse race. Then Prime Minister Scott Morrison didn't see a problem with it. The Opera House is a symbol of Australia, a World Heritage Site, a cultural landmark, and a monumental urban structure. Activists say it shouldn't be commodified. The New South Wales Premier will take the new lighting policy to the state cabinet for endorsement in the new year. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny has been located, and he has not lost his acerbic sense of humor, despite the fact that he has been moved to an unforgiving penal colony in the Russian Arctic. Navalny, of course, is Vladimir Putin's most vocal critic and has been imprisoned in Russia since 2021. A few weeks ago, his team lost all contact with him. Then yesterday, Navalny's spokesperson announced that he had been moved to the IK3 penal colony, nicknamed the Polar Wolf, since it's in the Arctic Russian town of Kharp, about 1,200 miles northeast of Moscow. Navalny himself posted on Twitter today with the help of his outside lawyers. Journalist Mikhail Fishman covers the politics of Putin's Russia for the Russian independent channel TV Rain. He joins us from Amsterdam, which is where TV Rain has been broadcasting from since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine almost 2 years ago. Mikhail, in his tweet today, Alexei Navalny described his journey to the Polar Wolf penal colony. What else did he say?
He addressed his supporters in his famous ironic and witty manner, saying, "Hey, I'm your new Santa from beyond the Arctic Circle." So he displays his well-known absolute fearlessness and courage. That's the main message, that he has not been broken in these new circumstances. He is still who he is. He described his cell. He described the absence of light because it's absolutely dark now beyond the Arctic Circle.
Mikhail, what do we know about the conditions? I mean, you mentioned the cell and how dark it is, but conditions generally at this penal colony in Kharp, a town in the Arctic. It's well away from Moscow.
It's a penal facility which was built, I guess, in the 60s over the former Gulag site, Gulag prison. It's extremely remote and at extreme north, and that pretty much sums it up. In winter, it's minus 40 Celsius, which I think is probably minus 40 Fahrenheit. And in summer, it's just clouds of mosquitoes and gnats. It's known as one of the harshest penal facilities in Russia, and Navalny's communication with the outside world will be, as we assume, much harder now.
You know, from outside of Russia, it looks like a slow-motion assassination of Navalny. Do you believe that is the intent of the Kremlin, to just keep hardening his living conditions until worse comes to worse?
I think that their goal is, at least for now, is to make him silent. Putin, I'm positive, still fears his abilities to affect the outcome of the so-called election next March, Putin's re-election to start with.
Yes, so you don't think it is a coincidence that Navalny has been moved to this really remote prison colony after the announcement that Russian presidential elections are coming up in March and Putin will be a candidate?
No, absolutely not. I think that that's why he was lost for almost a month. I think that it was a great success of his team that he was found so early. The idea was that he would be found much later because now it's a Christmas break. And in Russia, it's a very long Christmas break going further until mid of January. And if he wouldn't be found now before the new year, he would be probably found only in late January. So he would disappear for more than a month.
Have you ever interviewed or met Alexei Navalny, Mikhail?
Yes, of course, many times.
Yeah, so you've got a pretty good sense of what motivates him. What is the most important thing to know about Navalny in terms of his strength in the face of constant persecution by the Kremlin?
What's crucial is that he is absolutely fearless, that there is nothing literally that can stop him from being what he is. He is a Russian oppositioner coming from the street, believing in what he does, and fighting Putin's regime starting, I would say, from 2010-2011. So that makes 15 years. And he was always who he was. He never changed anything in what he did, in his political platform, in his political program, in his political action to make it easier for himself. That's the most important thing.
We will leave it there. Mikhail Fishman is a political journalist and anchor at the Russian independent channel TV Rain. He joined us from Amsterdam, TV Rain's base of operations, since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine almost 2 years ago. Mikhail, thank you very much. Good to speak with you.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
In Britain, the day after Christmas is known as Boxing Day. Nothing to do with fighting or sparring. Traditionally, it's about putting together boxes of gifts for those in need, or if you are a noble, for the staff downstairs. These days, Boxing Day is all about shopping, sports, and in the seaside town of Cromer, some other unusual traditions. Reporter Leo Hornack explains, and to do so, he has to get very cold.
In this part of rural eastern England, right by the sea, there's a ritual that I've always heard of, but never even been tempted to take part in. The Great Boxing Day Dip is a mass swim in the icy North Sea on the day after Christmas, an act of collective self-inflicted hypothermia, started by this man.
I've only missed 1 year in 30 years, so I can't really stop now.
Clive Hedges is the organiser of the dip, the ringmaster. We're standing on the boardwalk with just an hour to go, and the wind's making white foam on the waves, what are called white horses here in England. But Clive's not deterred.
It was started by just a handful of people, but now it's a massive thing. We expect thousands of people to line the promenade, about 400 to 500 people to run into the sea. My advice is to wear something on your feet, because we're not sure what's under the water.
In fact, everyone has some advice for a newcomer like me. This is Jeremy Bolam, another veteran.
You've got to get yourself totally wet. Don't be one of these people who just run in and splash it around their knees and they say they've done the Boxing Day dip.
It feels like I've somehow enrolled in Chroma Dip boot camp.
You've got to go right in and get your head wet.
Head wet?
Yep, that beard's got to go in. Totally immersed.
I must say, I mean, I know this is normal, but I can see quite sort of white horses rolling out from the horizon.
Yes, and your problem is?
In spite of what the PA system is playing on the beach, it's hard to imagine a less Copacabana tropical scene than Chroma on Boxing Day. If you continued swimming straight ahead after the dip, the next landmass you'd meet would be the Arctic ice sheet. Not everyone is convinced this is all a good idea.
I'm definitely not doing the dip. Really unfortunate, but I have to work. Otherwise, I probably would definitely not do the dip, even if I wasn't.
Naturally, a British event like this needs a tea and cake stand, brought to you by Claire and Verity. They prefer to stay dry and warm.
No, I have no interest.
if we're not here, if we chose to go swimming, who would feed them sausage rolls and soups? We're fueling the nation.
Exactly.
Do not go out of your depth. Do not dive in shallow water. Might be rocks there.
Okay, there's lots of people sort of wobbling around me, trying to stand on one leg as they get their shoes off. I'm going to try and get my own socks off. Bloody hell, even the sand is cold. Yeah, I'm beginning to regret this.
I am absolutely ready. I've never been more ready. My whole life has been planning for this moment right here.
Right, I'm looking back now. There must be about at least 500 people on the beach. I don't think I've ever seen so many people wearing bikinis and woolen hats at the same time. It's quite a uniquely Chroma fashion choice. Oh my God, here we go.
Oh my God, that's cold. Oh my God, that's cold.
For the world, I'm Leo Hornack, Chroma, East of England.
You're listening to The World. People who have simply been in the presence of the Dalai Lama have said it's changed their lives. Even fewer have had this kind of encounter.
The Dalai Lama came over to me and he gave me a big hug.
How a press conference led to an exploration of Tibetan exiles around the world and understanding how they keep their culture alive far from home. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Thousands of migrants have joined a caravan of people in Mexico making their way to the U.S. border. This latest march comes ahead of a visit to Mexico by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, precisely to discuss the migrant issue. Arizona is one state seeing a rise in the number of migrant crossings. Human smugglers are shepherding people across vast stretches of desert along the border. At some point, they will encounter a wall. As we hear from Ron Nungan of station KJZZ in Phoenix, those walls have varying degrees of impact on migrants, smugglers, and animals.
You can walk for hours near the border in southern Arizona and never see another soul. The region is home to a diverse collection of wildlife, with nothing but mountains and desert as far as the eye can see.
It's a very rugged landscape, and you're dozens of miles from the first major highway.
That's Emily Burns of the Sky Island Alliance. The nonprofit has tried to monitor wildlife movement in southern Arizona since the Trump administration's border wall project began. The government waived environmental laws to expedite construction, and the alliance wanted to document animal behavior in the region.
And at that time, it was happening so quickly, there hadn't been any environmental studies to document which species are living and moving across the border in this area that was threatened by border wall construction.
They photographed thousands of animals each month. Ken Madsen of The Ohio State University studies migration issues. He says that rhetoric about border crossing can get overblown.
It is relatively quiet.
When the cameras do pick up people, it's usually border patrol or construction crews working on the wall. But people do cross, even in remote, difficult areas.
Clearly, some people and some drugs pass through the region, you know, obviously.
During the Trump administration, the government started work on a bollard-style wall with metal posts every 4 inches. Analysts say the project led to more roads along the border. In other words, the landscape became less rugged. The Border Patrol says recent closure of the pedestrian border crossing at Lukeville in Arizona could push traffic to even more remote areas. Years ago, those places would have been difficult to cross. Analysts say that wall construction has made them more accessible.
Right. So the irony is all those improved roads are being used by traffickers and migrants as well as Border Patrol. So essentially, you have provided access where access didn't even exist before.
Conservationists say the bollards stop animals, but not people. They're also concerned about stadium lights that have gone up along the border and places such as Organ Pipe Cactus National Monument. That could affect the behavior of nocturnal animals. Pete Bittigan of the U.S. Border Patrol says the agency works with conservation groups on a regular basis.
Protecting the environment is one of our key responsibilities when it comes to CBP and working together with our federal land managers.
He says there are no plans to turn on the stadium lights in remote areas at this time. Some of them haven't been wired.
As for lighting along the border in the Tucson sector outside of the urban areas, there's not a plan in place to turn on the lights.
Over the years, the government has found that building a wall is a learning process. They've learned to build gates and creeks and drainages, which stay open during the rainy season and closed later.
To help facilitate that, in a lot of these riparian areas that are really precious to southern Arizona, we have floodgates in place that we open up during flood season to allow water to go through and not cause damage to CBP border infrastructure.
Conservationists say it's important to see how animal traffic changes over time. The information could become even more important in the face of climate change.
This video shows a deer walking up to the barbed wire fence, and apparently it ducks under the vehicle barrier, but decides it can't get through the barbed wire fence and turns around.
That's Eamon Harity of the Sky Island Alliance. He says that animals may need to migrate more as the warming planet creates changes to water sources and habitat.
Animals need, you know, resources, food and water and shelter, essentially, habitat to exist, and they need mating opportunities, and they need to be able to move freely to access those things.
With smugglers taking migrants through increasingly remote areas, conservationists say it's proof that building more walls won't work. What the project has done is make it easier for people to travel, but harder for animals to find their way. For The World, I'm Ron Dungan. Phoenix, Arizona.
When China invaded Tibet in 1950, tens of thousands of Tibetans fled the region. Many people in that diaspora ended up in India, with a heavy concentration in the Tibetan capital in exile, Dharamsala. Many other Tibetans are now spread across the world, like in Australia and the U.S. Far From the Rooftop of the World travels among Tibetan refugees on four continents is a new book, and the title pretty much says it all. Amy Yu is the author and joins us from New York. Welcome, Amy. It's great to meet you.
Thanks for having me.
What inspired you to write this book on Tibetan refugees? What's the background and the starting point?
The starting point of the book is at a press conference in March 2008 in Dharamsala in India, where I was a correspondent at the time for the Financial Times. In March 2008 in Tibet, there were protests that had turned violent. It was big news of the day. So lots of journalists went up to Dharamsala for a press conference that the Dalai Lama was giving. So in that very first press conference, at the end of it, the Dalai Lama came over to me and he gave me a big hug.
Yeah, this is a pretty heady scene for you personally, right?
It was a complete surprise because as a journalist, you know, you're just observing and you're not part of the story. He came over to me and first he kind of pinched my cheeks like a uncle would. And, you know, he was really excited to meet someone who was even ethnically Chinese, even if I'm American. And he said, China and Tibet must discuss. It's between us and you must tell them. And then that's when he hugged me. So that was literally the first moments of my first visit to Dharamsala. And then when I was out and about in the town and interviewing people, I was really amazed at the town. And also that it's like a parallel universe in Tibet itself. Tibetan people were being detained, arrested, and shot at for demonstrating. And then in Dharamsala, there were thousands of Tibetans peacefully demonstrating out in the streets, doing things that they couldn't do in Tibet itself, like holding the Tibetan flag or holding signs asking for human rights, holding pictures of the Dalai Lama. All those things can get you arrested or worse in Tibet. That initial journey I thought would only take place in Dharamsala, but it extended to other parts of India and then other parts of the world as well.
So, Amy, let's take a kind of abbreviated version of your trip. I mean, let's start in Dharamsala. For Tibetans living there in Dharamsala in India, what does the geographic proximity with their ancestral land mean for their hopes for the future? I mean, is there one person you met who kind of captures the tension of wanting to be home, but also comfortable where they are and maybe knowing the limits of what the Chinese government would ever consider for Tibet in terms of autonomy, though probably never independence?
One person I'll spotlight is the person we meet in the very first chapter, who is a monk when we meet him, and he had been a monk since he was a boy. And he had left Tibet as a young man, went to India where he could study Tibetan Buddhism freely. And he lived in a monastery in southern India for many years. And then he had a big pivot when he started working at a veterinary clinic in Dharamsala. And that's where I met him. And then some big changes happened to him over time. We follow some of those changes in the book. I guess I'll give a bit of a spoiler, but, you know, in the middle of the book, he starts to fall in love with someone. That's not what you're supposed to do as a monk.
Yes, certainly a lot changes when people are in exile in their lives. Amy, in terms of Tibetan culture, there are some, including human rights groups and the Dalai Lama himself, who consider what's going on in Tibet a cultural genocide by the Chinese. I mean, you note in your book that an estimated 1.2 million Tibetans have died since China's invasion in 1950. I mean, you show in your book how Tibetans preserve their culture abroad, but what did you actually find was preserved of that culture and what was lost?
Well, language is a big part of it. So in India, as I mentioned, very established network of Tibetan schools across India and also in Nepal. They teach the curriculum in Tibetan language and then teach culture and history, geography, all these things that can't be taught in Tibet itself.
You met one Tibetan exile in Australia in this bedroom community of DY, it's called. His name is Dorji Dadul. He's in his 60s and has been in Australia since 1980. He teaches Tibetan language classes. I'm wondering, after more than 40 years in Australia, does he feel like he's doing right for Tibetan culture?
Yeah, Dorji is a good example. He was one of the first Tibetans to settle in Australia and helped set up some of those schools and classes, although I don't think he was a formal teacher at the time. He said some really interesting things that I captured in the book about how Tibetan language and culture, if you don't have that, then you're just another Joe Schmo from Australia. It was definitely important to him and to other leaders in the community. And I do think that message is being passed down.
What Dorji told you is really interesting, like he'd just be another Australian. It does not seem likely that the Chinese government will grant Tibet independence. Not impossible, but certainly unlikely. After researching this book and speaking with all these people in exile, Amy, where do you think the Tibet story is headed?
Well, first of all, the Dalai Lama and also the Tibetan exile government, they don't ask for independence. They ask for autonomy under what the Dalai Lama describes as the middle way approach. And so that means autonomy for religion and language and culture in Tibet, but not political independence. So they're asking in general for improved, better human rights and civil liberties, which I think actually Chinese people non-Chinese people in China also would like themselves. So I don't see these things in opposition. I think an ordinary Chinese person would also want to feel safe and to have improved human rights and civil liberties as well. So where things are going depend on the Chinese government.
I've been speaking with Amy Yee. She's an award-winning journalist and the author of the just-published Far From the Rooftop of the World, Travels Among Tibetan Refugees on Four Continents. Amy, thanks very much for taking the time.
Thank you. Thanks for your interest.
Ever hear an out-of-tune piano? It is not pretty. But in Australia, thousands of people may be stuck with unnecessary sharps and flats. Back in the fall, the world's Sarah Birnbaum sent this report from Sydney about the shortage of piano tuners down under.
It's a bad one. I think it's got a new string.
I'm in a recital room at the Sydney Conservatorium of Music, and David Kinney is tuning a Fazioli Grand. He's in charge of the conservatory's 160 pianos.
There's another one.
I don't hear anything wrong with it, but Kinney hears...
discord, really. It's this whining character to it, and the note is not sweet anymore.
A piano is a complex system of interconnecting parts. There are 88 keys, and pressing a key triggers a chain reaction. This reaction involves some 100 parts for each key. So multiply that all out, and you add in the strings and the pins and everything else, and you get 12,000 different parts. So a lot can go wrong, and there's a lot to take care of. When Kinney approaches a piano for the first time, he likes to play the first of Bach's 48 preludes and fugues in C major.
Through Bach's genius, he gives you a beautiful set of intervals that all talk to each other in major fifths and minor thirds and octaves and all that sort of stuff, yeah? That give you a feeling for the innermost part of the piano and the central part of the keyboard. I will use that piece maybe just to find the voice of the instrument. What is it doing? What's the character of the piano?
Piano technicians like David Kinney are a vanishing breed. There are only about 250 left in Australia and just 20 or so can service concert pianos. And most of them are close to retiring age. There used to be two undergraduate-level piano tuning courses in the country, but the programs were expensive to run, and they shut down after education reforms in the 80s and 90s. Meanwhile, there's no dearth of pianos. Australia imports 7,000 new instruments a year, and that's on top of the million already in the country. It's kind of like having a lot of cars, but only a few mechanics. And the farther away you get from the cities, the worse the shortage becomes. There are regional concert halls in Australia where the pianos haven't been maintained in years. Scott Davey is a concert pianist who has toured around the country, and he's had to play on some real doozies.
As a piano player, you're always at the mercy of whatever instrument is there when you perform. So it's quite a different situation, let's say, to a violinist or a flautist who's traveling with their own instrument. And if there's been an issue with it, you know, they've taken it to get repaired before they go on tour.
Pianists have no such luck. They have to be adaptable.
If you're playing a piece of music and you notice that a note is really not just going out of tune, but starting to sound quite painful, you sort of develop a bit of a memory for where those notes are. And every time it comes up, you just try to either leave it out or play it as softly as possible, or even to do a little bit of subtle rewriting where, you know, if it's a melody, you just put it in the octave higher or something like that.
And pray the audience and the ghost of Beethoven won't mind. Caroline Sharpen is hoping it won't come to that. She's the CEO of the Tasmanian Symphony Orchestra in Hobart. Tasmania is a small island off the southern tip of Australia, so it's remote. But Sharpen says she's got a guy, Rod Collins.
He's the one technician that reliably services all the concert instruments of Hobart. And he said to us last year that he would really like to take a step back and look towards retirement in 2024.
Sharpen says she knew they had a crisis on their hands, and not just at the symphony.
I was approached by the president of the Tasmanian Music Teachers Association, and she said, right, Caroline, if we don't do something about this now, we're all in the position of needing to fly in specialists to look after our concert instruments and studio instruments and household instruments. So I said, right, what are we going to do?
What they did was track down a piano technician in Sydney who could teach the basics. Then they found the money to put together a scholarship to send two Tasmanians to the big city for training and then fly them back home to practice. Sharpen says it's a good solution for her community, but, and you'll pardon the pun, it's not scalable.
It has to be a national training academy or something similar that accredits people and has them coming out and working all around the country.
Because, says pianist Scott Davey, there's nothing like playing on a perfect instrument.
When an instrument's not good, it's like trying to paint a picture with a stick. But when an instrument is really, really good, it's like having this almost limitless range of colors and dynamics and therefore musical possibilities.
And working to make it all possible, that unseen artist, the piano tuner. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum in Sydney.
Pianist Scott Davey there playing Lilacs by Rachmaninoff on a beautifully tuned piano at the Australian Broadcasting Corporation Studios. One thing from the start about the band Beirut, it's more of a solo project than a band, and the founder, its creative driver, is not from Lebanon. Zach Condon is American, born in New Mexico. Ever since he took an interest in music, Condon has taken the path less traveled. Condon's latest album, called Hadsel, is an example of that. He joins us to talk about it. Hi, Zach.
Hello.
So this album is named for the village in Norway where you recorded it. The village church is right there on the album cover. Take us to Hadsel. Walk us to the church. What's it like there?
The church is pretty old. I think it's from the 1800s, early 1800s, if I'm not mistaken. Wooden, octagonal, very humble but beautiful, yes.
And inside, describe it.
So inside, it's a very warm atmosphere because of the wooden, handmade quality of it. And it's has some really beautiful kind of murals, and the altar is quite an impressive piece.
And Zach, why did you go to Hadsel? What was the intent?
Part of the intent was to flee, was to run away. I had a really rough year in 2019 where I was really falling apart on tour, and I ended up canceling a lot of dates, and I've always had this kind of horrible relationship with the road, unfortunately. And I've always been obsessed with winter, and I used to always escape into these cabins in the woods in upstate New York and places like that, and I really had an affinity for that feeling of shelter against the elements. And I always wanted a more extreme version of that, actually, something that my bandmates weren't too keen on. So this time, because I knew I would be doing everything alone, that was kind of my intention from the start, I picked the kind of iciest place I could think of, and I think I found it.
Zach, your albums typically have featured old world instruments like accordion, ukulele, lots of brass, lots of inspiration from really all over the world. On this album, there is a foot-powered pump organ, as we just heard. You can hear kind of the crinkle of the leather even, those bellows blowing air across the reeds. Now, where was this organ?
That organ was in the cabin, and it was one of the reasons I decided to go to this place in particular, in this island, is I had found a place in a picture of the living room. There was the pump organ.
Mm. So in terms of kind of recuperation and what Hadsel, this place in Norway, gave you, how much time there was about rest and how much was about creative work? Like, what was your typical day there like?
Yeah, you know, I very much intended to do more rest, and I, I don't think I had it in me, because when I sit too still, my mind takes over, and it's not always taking me to the nicest places, if I'm being honest. So I spent 2 months there, January and February, really riding out the storms and the polar night, writing constantly. I would be doing 14-hour days recording, and then I would go to the church and record the church organ for 6 hours.
I mean, you said this trip to Hudsel was a kind of retreat, but my sense is that you can't stay away from production. You traveled up around the Arctic Circle with a lot of gear.
Yeah.
And let's say it's the kind of stuff that suggests you were not looking to rest.
You know, in hindsight, I don't think I could have. I think if I had really sat alone with my thoughts, I think I would have drowned in them. And this was a way of working through that. You know, this is something I've done before in some ways.
When you think about this geographic space of Hadsel now and your album, what song first comes to mind in making that connection to a place?
So like a song that represents Hadsel the most to me, almost?
Yeah.
In some ways, I would say it's the second song, Arctic Forest. That one was the one that I wrote probably in the most trance-like state, where I think I had spent, I don't know, 8 or 9 hours just making strange drum sounds on the modular synth while this storm raged around us. And it ended up being an Arctic hurricane. I guess the winds got strong enough to be qualified as such. And it was quite violent, and there were times where I feared the house would kind of tumble over, and I had to trust that the Norwegians knew how to build their homes, since they'd been doing it there since probably before the Iron Age, I think I've heard. So I came out of that with this, you know, adding this organ drone, and then the vocals all kind of spilled out before I even knew what I was doing. I mean, half of them aren't even real words, and in my eyes, that becomes kind of a representation of that place, in the sense of the kind of drums representing the weather and the outside elements and the ferocity of that and the intensity, and the kind of drone of the organ almost representing this kind of home and hearth, like fireplace, protective environment.
Zach, your artistic moniker, Beirut, I mean, a random suggestion made by your brother who knew of your interest in the Mideast, and your own attraction to global musics. Would you say Hadsel is a part of that, kind of a continuation, or something else that is different in your musical life?
With Hadsel, I think in some ways I was almost poking fun at myself a little bit by, of course, dropping the city names, as I always do. And in other ways, it was a return to form. It was a return to the original kind of adventure in the mind rather than actual adventure. So, I don't know.
Norway is not a warm place. How do you feel about the cold now?
Oh, I love the cold. I really flee the heat. You know, I think people assume that where I grew up was some sort of blazing Phoenix-style desert, but that's really not true. Santa Fe is super high up in the mountains, 7,000 feet. I was always used to the cold. I was always used to the snow, and I was a night person, so I rarely saw the sun, and still do. And I like that. I think I go for that extreme, and perhaps it just suits my inner world a little better.
Given that, Zach, what would you like me and your listeners to take away from this latest album of yours?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question, because I try purposely not to force too much imagery on people, and I would very much like for people to take it their own way. But in other ways, I'm like, you know, sit down and enjoy the fire.
Multi-instrumentalist and songwriter Zach Condon records and tours under the name Beirut. His latest album is called Hadsel. He joined us from Berlin. Zach, thank you very much, and happy holidays.
Same to you. Happy holidays.
Music from Beirut's new album, Hadsel, brings us home, as well as hearth. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe. Stay strong. We'll see you again tomorrow. Before we go, Marco here with a quick reminder. Time is running out to donate to our fundraiser and help us unlock a $67,000 matching gift. If you've been meaning to donate but haven't yet, we need you to step up now. Your gift will help sustain our newsroom into 2023. Learn more and donate at theworld.org/give.